Okay, so tonight's talk is and discussion is about guidance that we receive at various times that appears to be contradictory or in conflict. And how are we to understand this? How are we to work with it so that it makes sense, that it just doesn't remain an apparent conflict and we're not quite sure why or what we're doing with it. So I think a good place to start, it's always helpful, I think, to have a series of global principles that you're working with to set everything in context. At least that's my experience of practice and of understanding practice and understanding the teachings. So there is a sutta that is called What the Teachings Are Not. So, yeah, you're right. I saw that one. I want to read that one right away, you know. And it's a long sutta, but it's a fascinating sutta because it goes through and basically outlines for you what were the predominant philosophical and spiritual theories that were being advanced in the day. And from the Buddhist perspective, why none of those are consistent with what he is teaching, and that they are in fact destructive because they don't liberate the mind. They cause the mind to become attached to something primarily for security and safety, or that they deny things so that life ends up being devoid of any meaning. So it's a fascinating sutta. So there's a whole theory section about philosophy. There's a section about many different techniques that were being used by different schools. And you may be aware that the Jains, which still exist, at the time, you know, India was a hotbed of spiritual development and different teachers and it was an agrarian economy, and it's helpful to remember that, you know, the Buddha traveled every place by foot, so that in his entire lifetime, the scope of his physical travel was something in the neighborhood of 250 miles. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you read the suttas, and they'll usually start out and say the Buddha was staying at X, and they'll mention the city. And then if you just start tracking those, you know, like if you just did dots, you suddenly see that the space, the physical space, wasn't all that big. So a lot of the teachers were bumping into each other. One would come in and teach, and then the next week another one would come and teach. That's where the Kalama Sutta comes from, the area of Kalama, where they were having so many people come in. The Buddha gave this talk in response to the community, basically just saying, there's so many of you guys coming in here, you know, we don't know who we should believe and why should we believe you. That's where the Kalama Sutta comes from. So this sutta distinguishes a number of the practices of the day, and although it's, for some reason, it's not emphasized too much, the Jains were ended up actually being the primary rival group to the developing Buddhist perspective. And if you go to the Jain temple in Sarnath, they have the history of their leader, you know, the dates and the different things that he did and when he did them. And it's like eerily similar to the biography of the Buddha. I mean, really amazing. And, you know, their teachings compared, you know, the Buddha was the middle way, the Jains are quite extreme, you know, in terms of avoiding harming anything that is living. And so, you know, when you visit the temple, you know, the Jain communities actually don't wear clothes, you know, because they don't want to. And so when you visit the temple, the guide isn't nude, but, you know, he's wearing like a little loincloth, right? That's the closest they can get and feel like they're still ethically in place. So many of what the Buddha was doing was taking practices of the day and either slightly changing them, and even with a slight change, they would take you to a different place, or he was spiritually or philosophically placing the teaching in a different context so that when you practiced with it, you were practicing with a different intention. And from a Buddhist perspective, intention is everything, right? That is the starting place. It drives thought, emotions, conduct. So in this talk, one of the really important things coming out of this, what the teachings are not, is the difference between wise and unwise attention. And the Buddha says that the big problem that all of us run into is we're just putting our attention in the wrong place. You know, so our attention is, desire is encouraging us to pay attention to a particular thing or person or goal to the exclusion of a balanced view of that activity in comparison to other things, or aversion or hatred is pulling the mind constantly into negative self-talk or criticizing others or focusing on a particular person as being the source of all your problems. But, and of course, the mind is always attributing all of that to what's out there, not what's in here. And so one of the most important teachings, I believe, of this, and then he follows it up with very specific suttas on the same topic, is where we put our attention, in essence, determines where our practice goes. And it's part of the reason that so much of this practice involves repetition and discipline, is that we're trying to learn how to develop the ability to consciously choose to put our attention where we want to put it and keep it there, rather than having it put there by some urge or emotion. Okay. So that's the starting context for this. How do we look at teachings that appear to be in conflict? So what I'm going to start with is there's a principle in Buddhist practice called bhavana, which means a becoming. And it can be positive in the sense of we are developing ourselves so that we are growing into bigger, more mature, more sophisticated, deeper states of mind and right view. It can also be used negatively, bhavana, in the sense of that we become separate, we become the individual who feels that they are being attacked or all these different things we feel through dependent origination, you know, very clear steps. So bhavana can be that kind of bhavana, or bhavana can be positive, all right? So the positive development is just replete in all the basic Buddhist teachings. You know, we've got learning the Four Noble Truths, that serve as the foundation for the Eightfold Path. And then each step in the Eightfold Path has, you know, myriad number of teachings and techniques and methods and all these things. They all traditionally take us through stages of development and stages of insight. Okay, because this practice, we don't gauge progress by Western psychological markers. We gauge it based on specific types of insight that lead to changes in behavior and relationship. And so there's traditionally a series of markers. And so it's clearly that there's a progression, right? And that you're developing. So then, on the other side, and this is what I would say is one of the things, or at least that hopefully you've struggled with this, I'm not the only one that's struggled this, is one of the ones that I really struggled with is in opposition to this whole myriad number of techniques and teachings that are about development and that you're avoiding trying to strive too much, there is the teaching that we should see and accept things just as they are. Okay? And one of my favorite quotations, both because it confused me and because it is such a refuge sometime, is from Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah was in the Thai forest tradition. When I was coming up as a student, he was just quoted all the time. We don't hear people quote him very much anymore. But there's some wonderful little books that have been published. He never wrote a book, but many people, Westerners who studied with him, wrote everything down and made books into it. So this is the quote. And you know that it's going to be deceptive by the title. And the title of the poem is, "The Path is So Simple." Okay. The heart of the path is so simple, no need for long explanations. Give up clinging to love and hate, just rest with things as they are. That is all I do in my own practice. Do not try to become anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not become a meditator. Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. Of course, there are dozens of meditation techniques to develop samadhi and many kinds of vipassana, clear seeing. But it all comes back to this. Just let it all be. Step over here in the cool, out of the battle. So, this is a fascinating quote, right? Because we listen to all these Dharma talks and we listen to the suttas, and then you have somebody who really is the real thing and a respected teacher saying, don't try to become anything, right? Don't make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. You know, I remember Ram Dass would always say, people come up to me, who don't know me, and they introduce themselves, and they'll start by saying, well, I've been meditating for 8 years, And he said, and they say that as if that's supposed to mean something to me. He says, because you don't have an idea at all what that means unless you know what the person has been doing, right? So that if they've been doing it selflessly, 8 years of that gets one result. Another thing, if somebody is striving, and so you would say, you obviously have to become a meditator and be a good meditator, but that's not the point. That's just part of one of the tools, the vehicles, the avenues to help you get there. So, and this is not a rhetorical question now that I'm posing. How do we reconcile these two things? How do we reconcile this whole huge set of suttas and instructions to do things and ostensibly to become things, and then this quotation where he is saying, and the important part is that at the heart of the practice, it's simple, So what do you think? How do we reconcile this? Excuse me? Sure, yeah, good, I should have done that. The heart of the path is so simple, no need for long explanations. Give up clinging to love and hate, just rest with things as they are. That is all I do in my practice. Do not try to become anything, do not make yourself into anything, do not be a meditator, do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. Of course, there are dozens of meditation techniques to develop samadhi, concentration, and many kinds of vipassana, clear seeing. But it all comes back to this, just let it all be. Step over here where it is cool, out of the battle. So that last line I like a lot. A lot of times when my mind's just kind of going crazy, you know, and you're awake enough to realize that your mind is just making it up, you know, this whole thing, that line is really helpful. Like, hey, just come over here, you know, just come over here and sit down for a second, little boy, you know. And so, okay, so yes.
In the moment, I add that. I add those three words. So I think you can accept things as they are in the present moment, but then you get to act. And you can act with wisdom, and that may cause things to change, perhaps in a better way. You know, you can have a, you can want to change things in the future. That's, to me, that reconciles that part, and then...
Which is very tricky, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because to...
Simple.
To want things to change in the future, and then to accept them in the moment, it's really a razor's edge, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very difficult, yeah. And then the second thing is about, if you're not going to become a meditator, then why even meditate, or what's the difference there? Well, again, this is also a razor's edge thing, but I think a lot of it has to do with making an identity out of things. So, again, you know, it can be wise to do a certain thing, but you just have to watch. You have to watch your tendency to want to create an identity out of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Very good to create an identity, create a view, a fixed view, right?
Yeah,
and become attached to it.
You have to continue to watch for it because, like right now, maybe the best thing that I can do is meditate. And if I say that every day and I'm meditating, then, yeah, I am going to, there are going to be some changes. So continuously, I might start to feel attachment towards what happens when I meditate. And if I'm doing that, then I'm getting off balance, and those things are not reconciled.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So a lot of good material here. A couple little things we want to add in there as we keep going, and the extreme of what you were saying about is that just look at the different forms of Buddhism and the conflict between them. You know, and what is that about? I mean, it's about people becoming deeply attached to seeing things in one particular way, and so deeply, the holding on is so strong that an unwillingness to entertain competing views that, you know, there's always the possibility that there's two competing views, both of which are right, you know, depending on the view. So extreme of this, and this is part of what the Buddha was talking about in the sutta, is fundamentalism. You know, you just become locked into it. And actually, I read an interesting article the other day of, you know, the mindfulness movement has become so big and commercial now. And it is not what we're talking about tonight, by the way. But the article was entitled, Can We Be Saved from Mindfulness Fundamentalism? And how kind of a whole similar thing is developing where there, you know, are certain groups of people who, for commercial and many other reasons, want to define mindfulness out in the commercial market in a particular way and are criticizing other groups. So, you know, that whole thing is developing now, which you know how big it's gotten when that starts to happen, right? It's not enough for everybody just to have a little piece of the pie. Now we're trying to get control of it. So, Okay, any other thoughts on this? Yes. So are you describing the sickness that we're all suffering from? or are you saying that what he is saying here is no longer applicable or is not applicable to Western American life?
I'm reading a book, I just finished it. It's called Faith by Sharon Salzberg. And she was one of the folks along with some of those early folks that you're talking about, Ram Dass, et cetera, who they connected to their understanding of Buddhism by going to Southeast Asia, by going to India, where, and we can't do that. We don't, that's not really conceivable. But, and she went to all of the different forms of Buddhism. She went to Tibet.
Okay. So, but you, I want you to go to the answer to the apparent contradiction in Ajahn Chah. So, is your feeling that Ajahn Chah's advice isn't applicable to us?
Oh, I think it is.
Okay.
Very much so.
Okay.
And it creates a spaciousness that is very hard, it seems to me, that is inherent in one of the gifts of Buddhism, and that's not an easy thing to bring or incorporate because of the nature of the culture that we have.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Yes.
Dude?
Yeah.
And I always, when I heard that word abide, it was an interesting word to me. There was a certain truth in that wisdom, yet it did not seem engaged. And
this didn't seem engaged, or the dude didn't.
Lebowski did not seem engaged. So in here, what the paradox that I see in there that it reminds me of is the paradox between being active and being passive. So in intention, so much of intention is about manifesting something of self that we want to be manifest in the world. And I think that sometimes works and is wonderful, but I think that the concept of preparing yourself through technique and through discipline to receive life's givens and graces is a very active thing to do, preparing yourself to receive. And it is preparing yourself to be able to respond to life, what is now. And we talk about responding rather than reacting as a fundamental goal in meditation to open up space. So you can respond rather than react. And I think all the concepts of allowing and accepting and taking to heart are active practices that help you respond to life.
So when Ajahn Chah says grasp at nothing, resist nothing, you're seeing that as an active
admonition. Yes,
yeah.
Just prepare yourself to respond.
Yeah. See, I think, you know, there's really three choices that we have. You know, we can in any given moment, the choices are we can respond to something and to develop a wholesome, skillful response to it. Either develop what's already there or start something new, okay? Or we can continue to be not dysfunctional and be reactive, okay? Or we can engage in what our culture doesn't like the word, but the traditional word is renunciation, which means restraint. And if you think about it, so much of how we get ourselves in trouble is simply by not exercising restraint. You know, like you have an urge and you just act on it, you know, or you have an emotion and you don't reflect on it first, you know. So, you know, actually the development and the restraint are of equal value, you know, and I think this is where it gets confusing. You know, there's so much talk about the Eightfold Path and, you know, we're going to metta and we're going to, all the stuff we're developing. It gets lost that the Buddha valued restraint and development as of equal value, you know. And so, and the restraint is an active practice. It's not passive at all, you know. So, okay, one more, yeah.
I was going to suggest that Ajahn Chah's phrase of let it be reminds me very much of the Taoist way of thinking, which is the universe is best governed by allowing it to take its own course, letting it be.
Yeah, for sure. And I, for me, I mean, the confusing part of that, when I first was working with it, well, I mean, how do I let it be when, you know, we're defining things as skillful and unskillful and moral and immoral and, you know, what do you do? So, to try to put this, this is a very long answer. You know, this is, we could, just on this question, we could do, honestly, 5 or 6 weeks, you know. It's a fascinating topic. But to give some context to it tonight, understanding where we're putting our attention to answer that question becomes the important consideration. So, like when Ajahn says, don't try to become anything. Don't try to make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. Do not become enlightened. What he's saying there is all those are desire or aversion or ego-based actions. And so Boogie was talking, defined this as identity, you know. So that is absolutely not what we're trying to do. We're trying to dissipate the tendency of the mind to classify ourselves as something or someone. That is the original problem, you know. And in his teachings, the very, 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 very last thing to go, you know, on the progress of insight, you know, it's like you've been practicing for years, you know, you're right on the cusp. Only one thing has to happen, and your mind's going to become completely enlightened. It's just going to, it's going to blow your mind, just, you know, and suddenly you're just going to be wide open. And that one thing is a disembodied sense of self. There's no body, nothing that can be identified, but there is a sense of separation someplace. So that's what dependent origination is about. You know, so he says when it's simple, you know, if you can get a hold of like where we're going and then just relate everything to where we're going, okay? And so dependent origination says the steps occur and then we start to separate from each other, and that's when we feel separate. That's when our mind immediately goes up into concepts of identity. This is the Honeyball Sutta, identity and personality, and then everything that we've got is then happens. Okay, so the whole idea behind this is let's get back to this original place. And so practice in one of the simpler descriptions is, you know, we're trying to learn through preparation and training how to be able to be present and maintain our presence in the current moment, to be non-judgmental, which means to be relatively neutral in what we're seeing. So when he's saying, you know, grasp after nothing, resist nothing, okay, that's non-judgment. That's whatever comes up. You know, it's like you're in a meeting. We can frequently do this in meetings, and we have trouble doing it in our own life. But you got 8 people in a room. You're at a conference table. You're talking about something, and a topic comes up, and you put that topic right in the middle of the room, and there's 8 people looking at it, and everybody just looks at it from all the different angles, and nobody's, you know, attached to the result, right? You're trying to get to the best thing. Well, that's non-judgment. It's like, well, what's there? What is it? What are the different angles? What am I missing? You know, building in the fact that almost always, almost universally, when any of us looks at something, we're leaving something out. That we're being unconsciously or consciously influenced by something to shade how we're seeing things. You know, I mean, there's even jury instructions on this. You know, that about how unreliable memory is, because we don't do it intentionally. But we keep kind of recreating our history to be consistent with our current view of, you know, good or bad, you know, that we're attached to. And that eyewitness testimony is so unreliable because, you know, like with an automobile accident, you know, the accident happens here. I'm seeing it from here. You're seeing it from there. You're seeing it from here. We're all seeing it, and we're all seeing a slice, right? But we're all sure that what we saw took place, right? So that's the non-judgment. And then the third element is being in balance or equanimous. Keeping the mind, you know, it's not that you be here now doesn't mean, well, I'm here and, you know, no emotions come in and no disruptive thoughts come in or no desires come in. It's the role of equanimity. When those things start to come into the territory, that the mindfulness sees it and balances it so that I can be present and non-judgmental. If you take away equanimity, it's pretty impossible to be non-judgmental. If you take away the non-judgmental part, it's pretty impossible to be equanimous. So if you take either of those away, you can actually be present. You know, there is a wrong mindfulness. You can actually be present that's totally incorrectly motivated. That's the reason, you know, there's such a controversy right now of all these studies coming out of how mindfulness is being used by the military, you know, to help, you know, our boys in service and girls in service to be more stress resistant, to be able to focus better, and which seems to me to be an admirable goal. And then, you know, there's a whole group of people who want to say, oh, you know, we're using mindfulness to promote militarism and help people be better killers. Well, I don't know about that, you know. That's another night for a good discussion, you know. Yeah, but I mean, if we really take the metta phrases seriously, you know, may you be safe and protected, may you be healthy and strong, may you be able to care for yourself, do we leave all of the young people who are in the military out of that? Is that the teaching? That metta is for everybody except our kids in the military? I mean, I don't think so, you know? And I have to admit I'm being influenced heavily on this now since my daughter's fiance and my grandson's future stepfather is a Marine. Yeah, hoorah! And that even made it fall off the chair. So that's been interesting for me because in my lifetime I haven't, a lot of good friends have been in the military and everything. I was in the lottery, so I didn't go to Vietnam. But I've never known anybody in the sense of being in relationship with them very, very closely, mm-hmm. who's been a real military person to understand how that kind of training and preparation affects them. So he's a Marine, you know, he's the real thing, and he's a gunnery sergeant, which is a gunnery sergeant. For those of you who have not seen the Clint Eastwood movie called Gunny, a gunnery sergeant is the person who is coordinates and controls all supplies. So whether it's a rifle, a tank, noodles, Band-Aids, doesn't matter. The gunnery sergeant is like the funnel point that coordinates all of that. So, you know, where it's stored, how it's moved, once it's moved, how it's delivered and gotten out to the, it's an incredible job. I mean, you take gunnery sergeants out of the Marines and all this stuff about the Marines, Marines fall apart. They'd be tough, but they wouldn't be very organized, you know. So he's a gunnery sergeant. So, I mean, like, I'm really learning a lot. And that's another illustration for me of how we have what he's saying, you know, we just have this emotional reaction and you don't think it through, you know. I mean, if you thought through it at all and say, well, metta doesn't apply to anybody who's in the Marines, you'd say, well, there's got to be something wrong with the way I'm approaching this, right? So all of these things that he's saying don't become something is that we're not trying. It's interesting because bhavana is becoming, right? But the negative part of bhavana is becoming, being born into a separate identity. So this is developing selflessness. This is developing an ability to see things as they are, meaning that they may be identity driven the way people are doing them, but in reality, they are not individually driven. You know, there are these greater things at work. So so back to the big principle, and this will wrap this section up: being present, non-judgmental, equanimous. What does that lead to? What that leads to is the ability of the mind to be settled, concentrated, and to be able to see what is present without being obstructed by everything he's listing, you know, by grasping or opposing. And it's that leads to clear seeing, insight, wisdom. So if we don't have those things, you know, the model for this practice is we set up those conditions and then we wait. You know, it's not a doing practice. You know, all of this mindfulness that's in the press right now, New York Times and everything, I mean, I'm getting so many mindfulness things now. I'm on my emails and my texts, I'm starting to unsubscribe. There's just so much of it, you know. All of them are about doing something to fix myself. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the fixing part of this practice is the antidote to hindrances. Okay, so like if I'm really angry, I practice metta because energetically it offsets it, you know? And so for each one of the negative states of mind, those are all temporary. This is the key part. Those are temporary practices to put the mind back into balance. Equanimity, one of three things to set up the conditions to see clearly. Those are not the goals in themselves. And my opinion is that what is happening with the mindfulness movement and actually a lot in our community, just because people want relief, is you start practicing antidotes to fix things, to feel better, and then your mind begins to believe that that's the practice because you do feel better. But that's the temporary fix. If you just keep doing that, you don't go to what the Buddha called liberation. And what the Buddha meant by liberation was slowly and systematically diminishing and uprooting and resolving what leads to those troubling things. And that takes this kind of patience, where you set up the conditions and where the real work is done in meditation, right? Where we have the ability to sit and wait. You know, we don't feel like we're compelled to do something as we are in daily life. But you can see that compulsion when we're sitting. So the training is we're developing how to be present, to be non-judgmental, to maintain balance. And then when that starts to happen, we wait, because insight, liberating insight as opposed to cognitive insight, which is a process of thinking, this is a meditative insight that arises from the meditation process, not from the thinking process. That's the reason we're constantly saying, you know, don't get lost in thought, don't become attached to thought, you know, come back to your breath, whatever it may be. So insight arises, and then we are at what somebody said, I think it was Boogie, is that in every moment there is a choice. And if we have prepared ourselves properly and practiced this, insight informs our choice, because insight develops wisdom and compassion. And then each small choice, you know, cumulatively starts to change who we are and what we think and how we act and our intention. Okay? Does that make sense? So it takes a little while. I mean, you have to kind of want to savor in this, you know. I mean, I really enjoy it because it's a beautiful thing. Because ultimately, what this practice is about understanding from a different perspective. That whole insight process is about setting up the conditions to allow your mind just to continue to be watching without wanting a particular result, without trying to make a particular result, but to actually see the truth of how your mind is working and how your emotions are working, and then this insight arises that leads to liberation. So I think we've lost some of this. I think we've, in many circles, practice has become about making certain results happen. And those results are the product of the process I just described. That is the precondition to having lasting change. I mean, we may, you know, temporarily be happier and more compassionate and what have you, but kind of like on the deep dive, you know, Buddhadasa always used to talk about the heartwood, you know, of the tree, you know, the real heart. The only way you develop the heartwood, as opposed to just change, you know, the appearance of the leaves and the bark, is through this kind of patient, sometimes tedious, and lengthy process. You know? And I think it requires, you know, there's another notion floating around, or at least I feel it is that you're not supposed to be, you know, passionate about practice, that you know, like I'm supposed to be so balanced and equanimous, you know, that, but I mean, I was raised by a generation of teachers who believed in the sutta that the Buddha gave where he said, you should practice like your hair's on fire. You know? It's like the idea that I could, and I'm speaking about when I first began practicing and when a couple of teachers lit me up. The idea to me that it was possible in this world for me to actually deeply understand in a way that most people don't, how my mind and emotions works and others work, and that transformation would come about through that, I just fell in love with that idea. I mean, that notion is like so extraordinary that could be a possibility. And so it really fueled my practice, and it fueled the practices of all my teachers. You know? So, okay, so there's there's another talk here that's going to be part two it's going to be about mantras. You know, like the one that I quoted as the headline was, "I seek nothing, I fear nothing, I am free," which is very similar to the metta or the compassion phrases. You know, may I be safe and protected with happiness. So, you know, is that an affirmation or what is that? Is that an intention setting thing? So that'll be the next talk. So about this talk, so any comments or thoughts on this and how it might apply to your practice? Yes.
What puts my hair on fire is realizing that, as you described those three principles of feeling equanimous and balanced and non-judgmental and present, if I just add to that one or two elements out of the Eightfold Path, out of the precepts that have to do with maybe ethical living, non-conflict living, I arrive at this wonderful set, like four legs of the table, so stable, of how I want to be, just how I want to be. So it's not becoming, it's just how I want to be. And if I know that in my heart, how I want to be, present, stable, ethical, then as life comes at me, the choices are exciting. When I first came to the practice, I thought wisdom was knowing what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And that would help me in my choices, making wise choices. But I found out it wasn't that.
That's
it was
right.
Just how I wanted to be. Then I could make choices, mm-hmm. and the world, my life would just unfold in front of me. Sometimes for better or worse, the choices were good or bad, but there would be another choice the next day too. So just getting comfortable with how I wanted to be and not worrying too much about the choices in duality, whether it was good bad. Let the choice be and then make another one.
Yeah.
Live each day.
Yeah, I think the Western model is, you know, everything's driving towards the choice. You know, that's where all the tension and the pressure is, right? I mean, that's the whole focal point. That is not the focal point here. The focal point is on the understanding. Because if the understanding develops through insight, the choice is actually quite easy. You know, something that seems so confusing and complex and layered, it's no longer that way. You know, it just opens the door to what the, and that's the opening part of his quote about how at the center of things, at the heart of things, practice is simple. That's what he means by that. It's not that there aren't all of these different practices. It's like, no, if you just wait for this particular kind of knowledge to, this wisdom to arise, this insight to arise, once it arises, then everything looks differently in terms of choices. Yeah.
I was going to offer a contrary point of view. You can take the recommendations for how to point your mind in the right direction, but in my limited experience, insight, the wonderful part is you have no idea what's really in there until it happens.
That's right.
There's no way you could ever imagine that you never would have thought that. Somehow you know it.
Yeah.
And that's, not experienced anywhere near all these layers of liberation, but it's a little bit of liberation that comes from that. Oh, that's the way it is.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
You could never imagine that was the way it was.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, Michael, thank you. This is such a beautiful observation and such a true observation, because the nature of insight isn't like cognitive insight where we just, you know, lead to what eventually appears to be a logical answer. Real insight is something that is frequently surprising. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are those times when it's like, oh gosh, why didn't I see that? But that's not the norm. The norm is that you see something in an entirely new way. And it's usually outside of the box. It's outside of your normal way of defining things. And that's the way you know that it's insight, because it's outside of any of your normal cognitive parameters. You would not come up with that answer, you know. And so you're right, it's thrilling. It's exciting. And one of the parts of wisdom is that you're saying, well, it would help me understand what I want to be, you know, just to be. I think the first thing it does is it starts to show you what you don't know. You know, we think we know all of these things about ourselves and other people, and just slowly, it just starts to dissemble all of that on you. It's like, geez, I thought I was, I'm not that up for disclosure tonight. but it can be shocking. It can be really shocking, you know, because you, for your whole life, have seen yourself and thought yourself to be one thing, you know, one aspect of your character. And then, you know, you have an insight, particularly on retreat, and it's like, oh my God, this, I've been misreading that my entire life. Like, you know, and so then that's really humbling. You know, like you really have that happen to you, and you go, my God, my whole life I thought this was my primary emotional issue, all right? That's not it at all. You know, it's what was below that was this. I mean, like, how could that possibly? So you have that happen, and then unless you turn away from it, you know, there's this stage called rolling up your mat stage. Where people have insights and they just say, too much for me. Yeah, I can't, I'm not ready for this, I can't handle it. And they leave the practice, you know, or they leave a retreat. But if you don't turn away from it, it's inevitable that you start to question the entire framework of what your cognitive framework of how you've defined things, because if for 50 years, you know, there was this whole framework defining something, and like you suddenly realize it's like really inaccurate. You know, it causes you to start to openly question everything. You know, so there's this tension in the practice where you'll have some of these insights, and the ego part of the mind is very threatened and it's frightening. You know, and you don't know what to do with it. You're confused about it and what have you. And then if you can just keep practicing, you know, the balance and the equanimity and the non-judgment, you know, the mind will come back into balance and see the value of it. But I've had insights on retreat which have like really knocked me kind of off my feet and taken me like 2-3 years to integrate until I got to a place where I felt it was fully integrated, and I got it, and it was worth 2 or 3 years of feeling uncertain and out of balance, you know. Anything else? Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I think certainly on mindfulness, John has been more responsible than any other identifiable person for popularizing mindfulness. And my experience of personally working with him is that he is really a really gifted and well-intentioned teacher. And he really lives the stuff. That was the mark of a good teacher, you know. I mean, there are such demands on him when I was with him nationally and now internationally. But, you know, if you're around that guy, I mean, you feel it. It's the real thing, you know, so. Okay, well, listen, thank you very much for coming. Hopefully all of our collective efforts and intentions here will contribute in some real way to a better world and to support all of our individual practices and our families. So thank you very much.